First of all, it was October, a rare month for boys. Full of cold winds, long nights, dark promises. But I suppose that this is really the story of my father. And that strange, leaf-whispery autumn, when his heart was suddenly too old and too tired and too full of yearning and regrets, and he didn't know what to do about it.
Was he sad tonight?
Much, Will. Makes me feel so dying old.
The carnival's gone. In the middle of the night? Hell yes, come on.
The sign says out of order, boys. Those boys, they've seen too much. Hunt them down.
Boys, what the hell's going on?
It seems to destroy people by granting their dearest wishes, as has been the way of the devil since God created the world. By the pricking of my thumb, something wicked this way comes.
Then rang the bells, both loud and deep. God is not dead, nor doth he sleep.
I know who you are. You are the Autumn people.
We are the hungry ones. Your torments call us like dogs in the night. And we do feed. And feed well. A taste of death. So you will know it when it comes again. Soon.
Please! I love you!
That's what they like! God! They like ears! Jump around, eh? God, happiness makes them run!
Something Wicked This Way Comes is the first Ray Bradbury story that I was ever familiarized with, and it is a story of a boy's coming of age in in horrific circumstances. It's back a few years in time, 20s, maybe 30s, and his town gets seduced by essentially the devil, who's promising everybody their deepest desire. And then, of course, in typical devil fashion, they discover that their deepest desire is their greatest horror.
Welcome back to Scream Addicts. I'm Jinx, your host, and that was Nathan Basil talking about Jack Clayton's 1983 film adaptation of Ray Bradbury's Something Wicked This Way Comes. Mr. Basil is an actor who has appeared in such television series as Cold Case and Invasion, and such films as 20 Years After and Off the Ledge. He is perhaps best known to horror fans for portraying charming slasher Leslie Vernon in Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie Vernon, which remains, in your host's opinion, one of the best movies so far this century. Mr. Basil, thanks so much for being on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Now, I got to ask, as with every episode and every guest, out of any horror movie you might have chosen to talk about at length, why go with Something Wicked This Way Comes?
I was one of the first I don't even know if you'd call it a typical horror movie, but you wouldn't call it a thriller. And because it takes place in the mind of a child and through the eyes of a child, just about anything is potentially a horrifying thing, and watching his progression of horror is just as affecting as any jump scares in my book. So it really affected me when I was growing up watching it, and it was one of the few horror movies that my folks let me watch growing up. I was kind of sheltered growing up. I always found it tremendously affecting, and is one that I've always held close to my heart.
You'd mentioned before that this was it your first experience with anything that had come from Bradbury? And can I ask, would you consider yourself a big fan of his and his writing?
You know what? I've never read any stories of his. So reading them, I've seen adaptations of his stories, but like Stephen King, I've never read any of his books. I've never read any of his stories. So adaptations are the entirety of my familiarity.
So the movie begins with an opening narration that kind of put me in mind of, a Christmas story a little bit. And we're introduced in pretty short order to our hero, who's, young Will Holloway and his best friend Jim Nightshade. And the two are set up almost immediately as polar opposites, I think. You know, Will is a bit more quiet and thoughtful, and Jim is a bit more brash and daring. And their differences, you know, in demeanor are sort of covered visually, I think, with their outward appearances. You know, Will is fair-haired, and Jim has jet-black hair. And, you know, it's a fun pairing, I think, these two friends. Although, I don't – what do you think? At times, it feels like it's almost
Jim
the two-hander.
Jim always bugged me so much because he was constantly – pushing and it felt like you're just gonna get Will in trouble, and you know, knock it off, kid. He was so he was just so insistent on breaking the rules, and that was, I found that very upsetting as a child.
Yeah. Now, can I ask you, do you see Jim as being kind of a good friend, or is he more the devil that sits on Will's shoulder throughout the story?
Yeah, I guess that part of the story obviously wouldn't happen without Will getting pushed outside of his comfort zone. So the antagonist is necessary component, but I'm not familiar in the book. Is Jim as large a presence? Because I could imagine some of the struggle that plays out visually in the two different characters, I could easily see that being resolved in some of his inward conflict.
Absolutely. It is definitely, I think, it's always kind of Will's story in a way. At least I would say it's more Will's story at times, and then in a way it's more Charles's story in a way too, you know, Will's dad at times. You know, and in fact, I mean, you know, looking at the movie, I mean, even though Will is the hero of the tale, you know, Will's dad, Charles, he does feel like the main character at times, insofar as, I mean, you know, it's Will's dad who seems to have the greatest arc, you know, in the movie.
Yeah.
And the greatest attention to, say, depth of character. When we meet him, he's initially worried about being too old to be a father to Will. And he complains that, what, he can't play baseball with his son. He can't keep up with the youngster, you know, but there's something more there you can tell early on. And, you know, there's that great conversation he keeps wanting to have with his son that his son keeps shying away from. And, you know, eventually they do get to it. And we learn that, you know, when Will was young, he was swept away by the river. And rather than jumping in to save him, Charles stood by and watched helplessly because he'd never learned how to swim. And, you know, it took, you know, Jim's father to leap in after and help save Will. And I don't know, you really get the feeling early on, I think, that sort of inability to save his son, even more so than his old age, that haunts Charles. And I think that drives him as a character.
Yeah. And my, like I said, my introduction to the film was as a child, but watching it now, I watched it not too long ago with my kids. And so I've, you know, covered the expanse from a child whose story is being told to viewing it through the father's eyes and his shortcomings, his self-perceived shortcomings. And it's interesting that the story does very much take place through, and I think it covers that span from the child's experience to the father's experience.
Absolutely. And, you know, it seems like those two things, I mean, the issue with age with the father and, you know, his, I don't know, would you call it cowardice, maybe, you know, the not having saved his son, you know, initially.
Sure.
I mean, but, you know, they really seem to push him, especially in the film's second act. And, you know, he's tormented by Mr. Dark when he offers Charles his youth back as almost a limited time offer. You know, there's that great scene where Dark is tearing pages out of a book as though they were, you know, potential ages that Dark could return Charles to if only he'd give up Will and Jim, you know, who Dark wants at that point because they've seen too much of the inner workings of the carnival. But, you know, it's an unbelievably cruel scene because we know what that means to Charles. And, and then, you know, there's just that moment where Dark breaks open Charles's hand, or is it his knuckles?
Oh, gosh. Oh, that image always, you know, and it's nothing compared to films today. You know, it's nothing. It's just a simple gag. And you know, maybe not even a good one. I can't even recall if it stands up, but But oh my goodness, it still just turns my stomach thinking about it. That the squeezing of the hand and the cracking of the knuckles. Ugh.
It's the one image that I always think of whenever I hear the title of the movie. And I think the movie is so much more than, you know, what horror there is in the story. But nevertheless, I mean, when I was a kid, that it just created a scar that has always stayed with me. So whenever I hear that title, I immediately think of that moment and the knuckles splitting open. And you're right. I mean, gore-wise, it doesn't really, you know, it's relatively tame compared to what we get in most horror movies these days. And yet, can you imagine a children's film on the level of, say, Something Wicked This Way Comes? Which is, I mean, for everything, it is a kid's movie. Could you imagine something like that today in a kid's movie?
No. And I think that's probably why it was so effective. I'm always drawn, particularly in horror, I'm always drawn to films that are far more suggestive than they are, explicative. You know, I appreciate a movie that requires that is demanding of the audience's imagination, rather than just instructing the audience what they're to experience. And that's something that I always found really, really great about that, or effective rather about that movie was that, there, you know, like you were talking about the father, there's a tremendous amount of regret, and it's not just regret that he didn't go in and into the river and save his boy. There are long, slow moments where you're, you know, they've parted for the evening or something like that, and the camera lingers on Jason Robards, the father, and you're just sitting there imagining the thoughts in his head, and as a father, I think about all those moments. You can't say goodbye when you leave the house and not have, or it's hard to say goodbye and leave them in a day and not think, did I do enough? Was that enough? If this was the last time I'm going to see them, was that a proper goodbye? Should I have said more? Could I have been more, you know, caring and loving? And there's never a limit to the more that you can do. But that's what I see now when I see those moments where the camera's just lingering a little bit, and you're being asked to just kind of appreciate what his thoughts might be, and that extends into the more, I guess you'd call them horrific moments, where, you know, the cracking of the knuckles. You've spent time caring about this man and caring about his desire to be more vital and virile, and his hands splitting like that is a palpable demonstration of his failure again to realize that. I appreciate being allowed into the head of the characters, and in a movie like that, really requires that you do.
Yeah, absolutely. And you did mention, you know, that notion of thinking, did I do enough? You know, that seems to be what the film is about at times, at least as far as Charles is concerned. And there's even that great line, what is it? You know, it's not what you've done that you regret, it's what you didn't do.
Mm-hmm.
And that definitely seems to haunt him. And, you know, with that knuckle moment, the hand cracking moment, there does seem to be, I mean, as horrific as that moment is, and it definitely is, but as horrific as it is.
But you realize we're talking about the movie right now, and somebody's going to watch the movie and they're going to go, that's what they were talking about? Really?
It will forever scar me. You know, I revisited the movie in advance of this chat, and it was getting close to that moment, and I was like, ah, it's probably not going to be that bad. You know, I've seen worse. How many Saw sequels did I sit through? I'll be fine. Mm-hmm. And I swear it happens, and it is a very simple gag, but I, you know, it happens, and I was 4 years old again. Yeah. And I was just like, gah. But yeah, it, you know, that is an injury. That is a wound, I think, that would fell pretty much any person. But with Charles, I mean, maybe it's that injury, or maybe it's the fact that his son is in danger, much more likely that, but it really seems to renew him in a way, and it gives him his youth back in a strange way in that finale, you know. And when it, you know, sure, he was guilty of maybe, you know, that cowardice of not being able to save his son, you know, when his son was a kid, but, you know, or much younger anyway, but, you know, when it counts, I mean, Charles does rush in to certain, you know, mortal danger, and he saves his son. And there's that great moment where, you know, he goes into the Hall of Mirrors and sees Will. And, you know, all he needed to hear from his son was that, you know, his son loves him. And, you know, that enables him to break the glass. He reaches in. There's that moment where it appears that Will is in the river again just before Charles pulls him free. And, you know, it's a great bit of redemption for that character. And it's really nice to have seen that in what is, you know, essentially a kid's movie, that they gave a character like that such depth and, you know, kind of an arc like that.
Yeah. And Jason Robards, I think that was probably the first film I had seen of his. And it really established for me just a lifelong appreciation of him as an actor. You know, the pathos that you just look at him, he looks like a real person. There's nothing gorgeous or extravagant about his features. He looks like an average person, and his acting was the kind of truth of the average guy. And so that's something that I always appreciated about him. And I, you know, even though he's that movie was, oh gosh, 20 years, maybe 25 years before his death, he played frail and flawed so well, with such generosity. You know, not a fun role, not a role that shows you off well, but he didn't hold back, you know.
Yeah, he's amazing in the movie. I think he was such a great actor, and I think it's to the movie's credit that it has a great cast. I mean, you know, in pretty short order after the movie begins, we're introduced to, you know, there's Jason Robards playing Will's father. We have Royal Dano, you know, who's fantastic. We have, you know, Diane Ladd. Jonathan Pryce plays Mr. Dark. We have Pam Grier as the Dust Witch, you know, I got to admit, I had forgotten that it was her who played that. So, you know, when she came on screen, you know, when I was rewatching it, I was like, oh my God, that's Pam Grier. How did I forget that Pam Grier was in this? But, you know, it has such a strong cast. And, you know, the movie has, if you look at it, this sort of considerable pedigree behind it, you know, with that cast and Bradbury's source material and, you know, Jack Clayton directing, you know, the guy who gave us, you know, that great movie, The Innocents, which is based on The Turn of the Screw. You know, it's a movie that seems to be fairly well thought of whenever the title is mentioned, and yet it's also a movie that seems to have been forgotten a bit, I think. You know, it isn't a movie that's mentioned often, it doesn't seem. You know, there were no 30th anniversary re-releases. Mm. You know, there's been no Blu-ray to hit. I think it's only available on kind of a bare-bones DVD. And, you know, I'm wondering, with a movie that's as well thought of as it is, and that's as good as it is, I mean, I think it's a hell of a movie, and I think most people think fondly of it. Why is it, do you think, that it's sort of fallen through the cracks over the years?
I think probably the dating of it, the setting, it's, you know, time gone by. And I think it kind of like A Christmas Story. You mentioned that a little bit earlier. Christmas Story is set from the very beginning as a tale that's being told of a time that has gone by. And I think that distances it, for some viewers automatically. I have always enjoyed jumping into a time that's not of mine. A culture and a time, settings that are unfamiliar to me, are I enjoy them because they're opportunities to experience something unusual, something not familiar, and for some people the unfamiliar is kind of an automatic turnoff.
Which is such a shame. And I mean, you know, you had mentioned earlier, you know, that the movie might take place in the 20s or 30s. And I was sort of racking my brain then trying to figure out, well, when does it take place? And I do, you know, me personally as a viewer, I kind of love the fact that it is set in another time. But it also has this feeling of being timeless in a way. I could almost imagine a version of the tale being set in any time, so long as it were, you know, small town America in a way. Yeah, but I, you know, it's such a shame that the movie has kind of, I don't know, been forgotten to some extent. And, you know, in doing a little bit of research, I found out that there was apparently a remake announced back in 2014.
Really?
Yeah. There doesn't seem to have been any movement on it since then. But, you know, I wonder, like, obviously I want it to be good if there is a remake. But, you know, part of me would kind of like it to happen because, you know, if for no other reason, it might shine a light on the older movie.
Yeah, that would be really interesting to see what updating, if any, is done, because there are a lot of qualities that, at least with my familiarity from the movie, it seems to be really dependent on small town America kind of themes. You know, that seems to be something that would probably have to go by the wayside because there's fewer and fewer people that have an experience or an appreciation of that quote unquote small town America.
Yeah, very true. You know, watching the movie again, it sort of reminded me in a weird way of, you know, Stephen King's Needful Things. Are you familiar with that?
I saw the movie. Again, I'm such a bad. I started reading The Dark Tower and then I got sidetracked somewhere halfway through it. That's as far as I ever got with a Stephen King book.
No, it's completely cool. I will admit freely, I have not read the book either. I have seen the movie Needful Things and, you know, like it quite a bit. But the notion of a, you know, this sort of malevolent, you know, entity, whether it be a man or not, you know, he certainly comes in the guise of a man, but coming to a small town that at least a, you know, on the surface appears to be, you know, relatively, you know, innocent as it were. And then, you know, he sort of preys on, you know, the people of that town and sort of seduces them with offers of things that they believe that they need or want. And
right.
I love that idea. Of course, you know, King's novel came well after, you know, Something Wicked. And so I got to wonder if there was any sort of influence there. But, you know, I love that idea. And I love that moment in the movie, just the setup of that carnival coming into town and appearing to assemble itself, you know, sort of from thin air. And the film immediately sets about setting it up as something sinister while demonstrating, you know, its powers the very next day. You know, the movie moves like a bat out of hell, you know. The next day is the carnival's opening day, and, you know, we get glimpses of the House of Mirrors that restores a man's missing arm and leg. And then there's the lonely man being seduced by the Dust Witch and then swarmed by, what was it belly dancers, I think? You know, which Jim glimpses in that great scene. And there's
peeking
lucky through. Yeah, that's such a great shot. I don't know what it is about that moment, but not necessarily his point of view, but there's that idea of, you know, just focusing on his eye through the hole, and he is like watching, and you just see the eye widening and widening, and you don't really even need to see what's on the other side to understand the effect that it's having on the kid.
A figure that really struck me from that movie, and I've seen him in other movies too. He's one of those character actors that you recognize, but I never knew his name. The lightning rod salesman.
That's Royal Dano.
Just what a fantastic I don't even know how to describe his performance. I mean, it's he's kind of the town loon, but the art, I would call it artwork of his lightning rods. They were all so beautiful. Yes. I wanted a lightning rod, and I never grew up in a town where a lightning rod would have any use, but I always wanted a lightning rod just because they looked so cool. The one with the scarab on it, and you know, just
the one that he sells Jim, I mean, is so cool. It's like I would pay a nickel for that. I mean, you know, it is neat. And that, you know, that great final moment with him and one of his lightning rods, you know, sort of vanquishing the the Dust Witch. I mean, it feels almost mythic, that moment.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a great actor. He was in if you look at his filmography, he was in loads of stuff throughout like the 50s, 60s, 70s, but I think horror fans would probably know him from like House 2, The Second Story, and Killer Clowns from Outer Space, where he's essentially playing kind of the same character from Something Wicked, or you know, he played the judge in Twin Peaks, and the only reason I know that is because I recently revisited Twin Peaks. But
yes, yeah,
and he was in it all too briefly.
I've got to look through his filmography, because I watch things and probably any actor that plays a character kind of like those that he plays, I'll assume that it's him, as long as they have shared similar features, you know, the kind of edgy, you know, extreme mind on the edge kind of, you know, character.
I would like to think that conversation happened several times in Hollywood. You know, we need a Royal Dano type.
Yeah. Probably not as often as it should.
Yeah, very true. Very true. Maybe Crazy Ralph in Friday the 13th. I don't know. But I would like to think that was patterned on at least one or two of his performances.
Yeah.
God, he would have made a great Crazy Ralph. Anyway, sorry. But, you know, it is, you know, looking at the introduction to that carnival and the way they build it and the way they show that it's, you know, it has all these various powers, but it's essentially doing that one thing, which is appealing to people's vanities or, you know, their desires and exploiting them in really terrible ways. You know, I think Mr. Dark has that line. What is it? Your torments call us like dogs in the night, and we do feed and feed well, you know. And it's even creepier when you find at the end of it that all of the people who have sort of succumbed to the carnival, they've been sort of claimed by Dark's carnival at the end.
Yeah. Yeah, that movie was just really unforgiving.
Unbelievably creepy. Like, I can't believe that it was meant to be a children's movie. And yet, at the same time, I got to say, I grew up in the 80s, and I miss kids' movies in the 80s, you know, that had a little bit of an edge, you know, that weren't, you know, they weren't extreme. They didn't go too far, but they weren't afraid to sort of walk up to the line, you know, and maybe push it a bit. And I think that's almost missing, sadly, in, you know, kids' movies today. I can't think of the last movie that seemed to be genuinely kind of spooky and creepy and, you know, potentially just flat out scary, but also directed towards kids. You know, maybe the last one that I can think of that at least immediately jumps to mind would be something like maybe Monster House, you know?
Mm. Yeah. But, my youngest, I was watching with my two boys, and, you know, I was, sit you down, boys, I'm going to show you a movie. They were enjoying it, but my youngest, who was probably 8 at the time, he got pretty spooked, so we had to turn it off at one point, which was really cool, you know. I mean, it's not the scariest movie in the world, you know, but I think it had just enough psychological tension to it that that it didn't let him off the hook, which I think is a good thing, and certainly the point of horror. If you're not getting viscerally affected, then it's not doing its job.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I think movies like that are kind of important in a way. You know, at a certain age, I mean, you don't want to scar a child by, say, cracking somebody's hand opener and showing their knuckle. Wait a second. Okay, you know what? But that was a perfectly safe scar to get from a movie. You know, it wasn't too bad. But I think, you know, creating sort of you know, I appreciated watching certain movies like that as a kid, you know, like that and, say, Monster Squad and, you know, a couple of safe, you know, borderline kid-friendly horror movies. They create, I think, important psychological calluses in a way.
Yeah. Well, when I was growing up, we didn't really do a whole lot of, you know, we didn't have, or we were pretty late in the game to get those cable services where you'd see movies that were unedited. You know, most of what I ever watched growing up was an edited for TV version. And I mean, I for example, I didn't know Animal House was as raunchy as it was until I watched the actual rented the film, because the movie that I was familiar with that I'd watched over and over and over again was the edited for TV version, you know. So, you know, the horror that I watched growing up wasn't very horrific. And it was rare that I saw a film and Something Wicked This Way Comes was one of them, that wasn't altered. It hadn't been edited because it didn't need to be edited. It was standing effective because it was effective psychologically. It wasn't trying to allure people with, I don't know, something that wouldn't be appropriate for kids. I was probably well into my teen years before I saw my first real horror film. And that was just because my uncle owned a video store, and we were visiting him for a week, and we had nothing to do but, you know, hit his store and you know, just pull everything off the shelves we had an interest in. But it was there that I got to see Nightmare on Elm Street. That was the first real contemporary horror film that I saw, and that was a completely different experience compared to Something Wicked, I'll tell you.
That I think everyone has that story when they're a kid, you know, the first horror movie that they watch and how it affects them. But inevitably, whether or not it was their first horror movie or not, I think everybody probably has the first time I watched the Nightmare on Elm Street story, because it's such,
yeah,
you know, if you grew up in that time anyway, if you grew up before Freddy was, you know, Santa Claus, so we're right. Almost. I mean, you know, I remember hearing about that movie as a kid first from my sister and brother. And of course, I was way too young to be able to watch it, which meant that I wanted to watch it all the more. And then eventually when I did get around to watching it, it was still kind of mind blowing, even though he had been, you know, kind of deluded by all of the sequels. And, you know, by that point, God knows, I mean, they probably had him selling soda and snacks at some point throughout the 80s. But I mean, you know, that is...
Well, I'm probably one of the few people that felt like I needed him diluted, because the concept alone, you describe it to anybody and it's something that you can identify. I mean, it's that is a childlike horror, you know, a horror that you would easily, you know, conceive of and understand as a child. You know, there's a man who lives in your dreams, and, you know, when he kills you in your dreams, you die forever. And, that's something you get as a kid. You experience that in your nightmares as a child. It was okay for me that excessiveness took root in those movies, because the concept alone was that had all the scare I needed.
Yeah, absolutely. He is, I mean, he's, I think, the modern boogeyman, even though he's been forgotten a little bit. But I mean, certainly when I was growing up, he was the number one guy as far as being, mm-hmm. you know, the thing that I most worried about being under my bed.
Sure.
But yeah,
sure.
But, you know, but when it came to movies in the 80s, you know, that sort of attempted to do scary stuff, you know, but they tailored it to children in a way. I think they had to do it in such a way that they didn't have to, but I appreciated maybe the fact that they still allowed their villains to be kind of scary. Again, I'm going back to the Monster Squad because that was a huge staple of my childhood. But when you watch that movie, I mean, it's kind of goofy at times. It's a little campy at times. It's a lot of fun, but when it comes to the villain, you know, that version of Dracula who appears on screen, you know, he is genuinely terrifying. And, you know, it's true of Mr. Dark in Something Wicked, too. Like, the movie feels creepy at times. It's mostly just kind of creepy. It's mostly just atmospheric. You know, the threat is kind of just there underneath the surface. But, you know, when Mr. Dark really gets going, he is a very scary figure. And I think he's really kind of impressive in that he's not, you know, knuckle cracking scene aside, he doesn't appear to be a physical threat that much. You know, it's all in how he uses words. It's how he preys on people. You know, there are so many great scenes that he has. Well, I think maybe two great scenes, but still they're amazing scenes that he has with, you know, Charles, you know, Jason Robards, where he tears him down just with words, and he does so effectively. And I think it makes him such a great villain. And Jonathan Pryce in that role too, I think, is just perfect.
Oh yeah. That was my, it was my first introduction to Jason Robards. It was my first introduction to Jonathan Pryce. And I think the second film that I saw him in was Glengarry Glen Ross, completely night and day different, kind of character, in the first, just so commanding and so, menacing, where his, just really impactful and impressive. And in the second, just this kind of withered, broken man in a way, you know, is he's adopted Jason Robards' character in Something Wicked in Glengarry Glen Ross, you know, a guy who's just been beaten so low that he just can't go much lower.
Could you imagine Alec Baldwin pulling that always be closing bullshit with Mr. Dark at all? Because I kind of want to see that. I want to see somebody try and make that short film.
I think Alec Baldwin would be down any chance he gets to redo that monologue. It seems like he's happy to plug it in.
Can't blame him too. It's an amazing monologue, but yeah.
No, it's ridiculous. And it was never, it was written for the movie. Crazy. Crazy.
Yeah.
It didn't exist in the play.
Wait, really?
Yeah, no, it does not exist in the play. It was written just for that movie.
Oh my God. Was it still,
crazy?
Was it Mammoth?
Yeah.
So, wow. Okay. No, I can't even imagine that story.
Something so classic and a scene that's just so perfectly rendered, and it was created. I mean, how many, you know, adaptations of plays or books does the new material exceed the original?
Maybe not the ending to August Osage County. maybe not that, but yeah, the wow. Okay. No, I had no idea. Surely it's been back to the stage after.
Oh, I don't
the
think
movie.
No,
so
has,
they had to have added that in, right?
I guarantee you every single production at least makes a salute to it. If they don't, add the entire, scene word for word.
I would hope they would add it word for word. Oh, my God. Yeah, I now want to go home and watch Glengarry Glen Ross. But you're right. I mean, Pryce is an amazing actor. And, you know, he certainly played villains before, but can you recall any other role that he did that had him be a sort of vicious, actively vicious as Mr. Dark?
No. And it wasn't – I think what's so effective about – his portrayal is that he's not acting it. There's very little that's demonstrative about what he is doing. There's such stillness in what he's doing, that's where the menace is. He's not projecting menace. He's just being a menace, you know?
Yeah. I mean, there almost seems to be this, you know, I'm thinking about when he catches Charles on the street and he asks where Will and Jim are. And, of course, they're hiding underneath the grate. And, you know, Charles has just seen them and he's lying to Dark. Mm. Even after that amazing, like, living tattoo moment on Mr. Dark's hands, which is so cool. I wish they had – I kind of applaud the movie for not exploiting that too much, you know. But at the same time, I wanted to see more, you know. But, you know, when Dark realizes that he's lying, you're right, there is a stillness to him, but there seems to almost be this restrained fury at having to deal with this guy who is lying to him. And then you see the blood dripping from his fist because he's clenching it so tightly. And it's like, this guy is a monster. And we never really see him go. I feel like one of the really clever things about the movie is we always get the sense that this guy is a monster, but we never see it. It's always hinted at, you know. And I don't mean in the sense that, you know, he would turn into a creature or something, but I mean as far as what he is really capable of. And I love that about him. I think it's what makes him such a great villain. That, I mean, not just his performance, but the dialogue he's given too. You know, again, how he can just cut Charles down so quickly with lines like, you know, he talks about Charles, you know, being a librarian. And he says, what is it? Something like, you know, all that time spent living, you know, through other people's lives, right, you know, dreaming other people's dreams. What a waste. And just the way he says it, it's almost fatal.
And he's smiling the whole time, just daggers of words, you know, shooting out of his mouth and smiling.
Yeah. He's such a great character. And it's one that I kind of wish, I mean, the movie, much like the book, it might have, you know, rendered this, you know, not possible. But I wish there were more tales with Mr. Dark. I would like to know what else he got up to. Was it much the same? Do you think he just traveled carnival-wise, you know, moving with the carnival from town to town, doing much the same thing? Because there is that hint of a backstory, you know, when Charles discovers that Mr. Dark had visited the town, you know, ages ago. And, you know, he discovers that his own father might have had a run-in with that carnival some time ago. And, you know, Dark even recognizes that mention that Charles makes. He says something, what is it, your father, you know, the preacher, that sort of half-man, you know, and the way he says it, it almost conjures this idea that there is this whole other story, you know, that comes with this town having been under the thrall of this carnival. And I just, I love that. I love how deftly Bradbury is able to sell the history of this carnival and Mr. Dark.
If you, it's, you know, say they're doing a, you know, 2017 remake of it, who would you see as a Mr. Dark?
Oh, God, that's a great question. You know, it's funny. I was, when I was doing research for this, I found that apparently the film's producers had initially wanted somebody like Christopher Lee to play Dark. And it's like, ah, that's really interesting. But and I love Christopher Lee. I'm not knocking Christopher Lee. I adore Christopher Lee. But if you cast somebody like Christopher Lee at the very beginning, then you already know what the deal is. Like he is, you know, I mean, he has sort of baggage with him. So if I were to fan cast Mr. Dark today.
I'm always so much more interested in casting against type, you know?
Yeah.
In finding somebody who would, especially in the bad guy role, you know, somebody who just is not obviously a mustache twisting villain, that always really appeals to me and affects me a lot more, I think.
Yeah, same here. I would probably shy away from casting, you know, like, who would the equivalent of Christopher Lee be today? Would it be somebody like, well, I mean, we were talking Freddie a minute ago. I mean, Robert Englund would probably do an amazing job as Mr. Dark. But I mean, the fact that you would cast Robert Englund in the first place, I think would come with the baggage that, you know, he has starred in loads of horror films. I don't know. I think the strength of Mr. Dark in the original movie is the fact that Jonathan Pryce doesn't necessarily strike you as somebody who would play that kind of role in the first place. So I don't know.
Did you ever see Once Upon a Time in the West, Sergio Leone movie with I'm blanking on his name, Henry Fonda, which was just a really fantastic casting choice because the guy, you know, he played Abe Lincoln, you know, he plays those nice guys, you know, that's just what he does. You don't think of villain when you think of Henry Fonda. And that's what made him so icky. It brought a quality to it that you just can't get, you know, casting somebody who just reeks of villain. There's something psychological that's employed when you're not able to write them off as a mustache twisting villain. You know, when they seem like they are nice or capable of being nice and yet doing horrific things, I feel that compromises the audience in a way that you can't get with somebody who's just blatantly bad.
I agree absolutely. And yet still, as I sit here, I'm racking my brain to try and figure do you have any ideas? Who would you cast?
Just in from that example alone, I would think, okay, well, you know, who's somebody that you would always think of, you know, as the, you'd never, Tom Hanks. You know, Tom Hanks as just this force of, as essentially Satan. Tom Hanks as Satan. That would be really interesting and pretty fucked up. And
he would not be dressed up as David S. Pumpkins, though, right? That might even be creepier, but I just checking.
It could.
No, you're right. I think they kind of used him in much the same way in, say, something like Road to Perdition, where, you know, he seems like such a cool guy and he's always playing a good person. And yet in Road to Perdition, like, he is a straight up cold-hearted killer, and it's kind of all the more riveting because of it.
Yeah.
Wow. That's got my vote. I would go Tom Hanks too.
Let's just go Tom Hanks.
Can we make this happen?
Tom, I'll get him on the phone. After we end this, I'll get him on the phone.
No, I would. It would definitely have to be something like that, I think. And I hope that if they do wind up making a remake, that they, you know, they hew closely to the source material and they pay it the respect it deserves. And I hope that, you know, it's something that I noticed watching the movie again is how, I mean, obviously part of this is probably, you know, just a byproduct of having been made in 1983, but, you know, it feels so wonderfully handcrafted at times. You know, all of the effects are practical. The
sure.
The lightning effects, you can tell, are drawn in, and yet, you know, it still works better, I think, than say the CG equivalent would. So if they do make a new Something Wicked, I hope that they, could you imagine that spider scene in 2017? It would be CG, and it would be terrible.
Spiders, and it would be, Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, the ants.
You're right. That's totally what it would be, because Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, you compare what they did with the effects in that movie to what they did in the 80s, and which is better? I mean, which had more money and which was actually better? I mean,
which evokes a response, a reaction, a visceral response from you when you know that it's CGI, and you can't watch something like that and not know that it's CGI. You're automatically let off the hook as an audience member, and you're allowed to disengage. And audience should never be let off the hook ever, especially in a horror movie. That's unforgivable.
I agree. I mean, you know, watching the movie again, I mean, that is, they put two kids in a room with like two dozen tarantulas, and that alone, like, I'm reacting to that on another level where I'm like, were those kids properly taken care of? Were they guarded from those demon spiders? I mean,
it's like the same thing that happened in Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know, and it's funny, it's Kingdom of the Crystal Skull and Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know, where, you know, at the very beginning, you know, he's got a tarantula crawling around on his shoulder and the guy whacks it off, and then he has him turn around and he's got 10 tarantulas crawling around on his back, you know. That scene is still effective. And it's just some spiders crawling around in it. You know, it's a simple gag, but it's real.
Yeah. And then the red ants completely consuming somebody is meant to be, I'm sure, more, you know, horrific by, you know, 1,000. And yet,
that's
when you watch it, it's just, you know, you shrug. Same thing with Shia swinging on the vines. It's just
nothing. I get nothing.
Which is crazy because the rest of that movie, I can't believe I'm talking about Crystal Skull again, you know, like 9 years after I promised myself I wouldn't. But
you would never talk about it again.
But, you know, I don't even hate the movie because I think there's some things that it gets right. And I think that's what's most frustrating about it is, you know, that scene when they pull Indy out of the car at the very beginning and toss him on the ground and he stands up and it's entirely in silhouette and he puts the hat on. Like, that feels like old school, you know, filmmaking.
Yeah, it
like
does.
Moments like that. And they undercut it with just, you know, nonsense at times. I hate it.
And I think it was an epidemic that Star Wars was suffering from at the same time. I believe Kingdom of the Crystal Skull came out just around the same time as Revenge of the Sith, maybe shortly after, and you know, and it was two franchises that were just plagued by the possibility of excess. You know, if some is good, more is better, but that's not necessarily so, especially in the case of CGI.
Yeah, and it is nice that, I mean, at least in Star Wars case, like, they seem to be going back to this...
Back to practical effects, yeah.
Yes, yeah, and...
Things being done on sound stages instead of green screen stages, you know?
God forbid. I hope that if they do make another Indiana Jones, they sort of follow suit in that way. And same thing, I mean, if we do get a remake of Something Wicked This Way Comes, I hope that they, you know, I hope that the scares are carefully crafted. I hope the effects are practical. I hope that there is an attention to atmosphere as opposed to just sort of bombast, you know.
I would imagine it would have to be, simply because, as you've discussed, you know, the part, something that is indelible about the movie, that's such a huge part of what makes it effective, is the language, the conversations that these characters are having, the hopes, the fears, the wishes and dreams, all of those things, how they're communicated, they're simple, and that's what makes them relatable, is that people can understand and relate to somebody who feels like they've been a coward in their life, and somebody who feels like they were meant for great things, but their possibilities were stolen from them in an accident, in a moment. You know, somebody who feels like they are, you know, getting stifled in this small town and made for bigger and better things, and yet they just can't get away. You know, that's where the movie and the story is effective, and there's just no getting away from that. If you're going to make that movie, you're shooting yourself in the foot if you try to run away from those little things.
I agree entirely, and I think, you know, that's all down to Bradbury. I think that's all down to the writing, and I hope that if they did do a remake, that they wouldn't try. And you're right. I mean, pull away from it and do something more cynical. I don't know how you could with that story, but I mean, I could see somebody attempting it and trying to make it a little too cool, maybe a little too, I could see almost an embarrassment these days with dealing with some of the emotions that original movie and the novel did. I mean, even take, you know, the ending, and, you know, some people might find it a tad sentimental and maybe even possibly a little bit cheesy, but, you know, I love Charles's realization at the end as to how he and Will can beat Mr. Dark in the carnival and save Jim, you know, and not with tears, but with laughter and joy. And, you know, there's that great line, happiness makes them run. And that's how they defeat, you know, the pandemonium carnival, you know, and it's leads to probably my favorite moment in the movie. I'm a horror movie fan. I mean, I love the atmosphere. I love Mr. Dark. I love the creepiness of the tale and the setup. But I think my favorite moment of the movie is Charles racing back to town along with Will and Jim, just laughing and energetic and seemingly youthful again. And I hope that if there is a remake, that they keep that spirit.
Mm. Yeah, it's funny. I'd forgotten about that moment until you brought it up. And yeah, that's I think because I was just wanting to see him having a moment of redemption, the father. I loved that moment, but yeah, the idea of it is still a really tender one as well, and holds up in my heart.
Yeah, which, I mean, all the best movies do, I think. And this is certainly one of them. Even though I myself, I've sort of overlooked it for a time, I'm so glad to have gone back to revisit it for this chat. And I would hope that more people would, too. I hope that we have inspired people to go back and revisit it, if not watch it for the first time. Because if they haven't yet seen it and they listen to this conversation, golly, did we spoil a lot. But
well, we didn't. There were some things that we left out. And it wasn't even artful or tactful. It was just out of omission. But there's tons of stuff that that is just so effective in that movie, and we didn't spoil. So there's lots of fun in store.
Still plenty to discover. So
that's right.
All right. I think that's just about our time, sir. Can I ask before we go? Do you have any final parting thoughts about Something Wicked This Way Comes?
I think it just came up in our conversation. You know, I watched it as a child. That's where my main familiarity with it was from a childish appreciation of it. But more recently, but more recently, watching it with my kids, seeing them experience it as kids, and then also having my experience of it as a father, and you know, experiencing my own shortcomings as a father and my own desires for how to, you know, care for them as well as they deserve to be cared for. That longing of Charles to be more, and you mentioned the word cowardice, and it's not something that I'd really thought of with him, but he is a coward, and he beats himself up all the time, and I catch myself doing that too, and beating myself up for just not doing more, and it is a kind of cowardice, because there can always be more, you can always say more, you can always do more. And that's what really struck me this time around, was my kind of reaffirming commitment to do more and say more. Yeah, that's what struck me this time around.
All right. We couldn't end on a better note, I don't think. So, sir, thank you so much for your time and for choosing such a great movie to talk about. I think it's an overlooked gem, and hopefully it's one that more people will seek out. Fingers crossed, anyway. Can I ask, where can people find you at online, and what can we keep an eye out for from you in the future?
I have Facebook. I have Twitter. I have Snapchat. I have Instagram, and you can find me on all those things. I have been teaching at my studio, Deviate Studios. It's in LA. Please drop by anytime you would like to learn how to be freed up from all of the harmful notions of what people want other people to think acting is. It's so much easier than people try to make it out to be. And I love pointing that out. And then as far as Behind the Mask goes, we've been promoting a comic book series. We've got a Indiegogo page that is promoting a comic book version of the sequel script. And, it's a pretty clever way to keep the ball rolling on it. So that's what we're doing right now, and the first issue should be coming out within a month, and I'm looking forward to seeing that myself, and then hopefully the sequel's not too far down the road.
Fingers crossed. I cannot wait for it. I want 14 more Behind the Masks. So I definitely can't wait for the comic. But if I can ask for just a second, the comic book is telling essentially the story that the sequel film would. It's not taking the place of that. Like, that film will still be made, I'm assuming, after.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the great thing about it is that because they're completely different formats, you can exploit the same source material in completely different ways. And I'm sure that they're trying to be artful and clever about how much to tell and how much to withhold. But yeah, you can tell the same story in two completely different formats, and they can be completely different kinds of ways of telling the same story and effective in their own right. So I just think it's a really fantastic idea because it stays true to what is really cool about Behind the Mask, and the sequel stays true in that vein as well, exploiting the conventions of horror, and in the case of the sequel, the conventions of sequels, and still leaves a whole lot of room to play in a filmic telling of it, because so much of what is relevant in sequels is the visual storytelling of it, all the visual tricks and tools that are employed, and that's not going to translate at all in comic book form. So it's really not giving anything away.
Excellent. All right. Well, whatever is next for Leslie Vernon, and I, speaking as a fan, I just can't wait for it. So, all right. Well, sir, thank you again so much for your time. And thanks to all you listeners out there. As always, please make certain to like, subscribe, share, rate and review us on iTunes. Tell your friends about us. Leave a comment below. And be sure to give us a yell on Facebook and Twitter. That's at Scream Addicts. And I am at Jinx1981. Until next time, folks, thanks so much and have a great weekend.
All that time spent living only through other men's lives. Dreaming only other men's dreams. What a waste.
Sometimes a man can learn more from other men's dreams than he can from his own.